This is the Library Thing Author Interview Podcast. I'm Sonia Green, today talking to author Mary Roach. Mary Roach is the author of Stiff, The Curious Lives of Cadavers, Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, and now Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Mary's also a columnist, having published in the annals of Discover and Sports Illustrated, and has been guest blogging at Boing Boing recently. She is one of my favorite authors because she blends nonfiction with popular science, along with humor and a level of geek out research that makes my little librarian heart sing with joy. Well, welcome, Mary Roach.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to let you know I've also asked some Library Thing members if they had any questions they'd like to ask you.
Oh, cool.
And the answer is yes. Yes, they do. Many questions.
Okay, great.
Including two marriage proposals. I'm not kidding.
Oh, they need to see me at some other venue than my author photo, which, you know, I had a hair and makeup person.
What? No, really? I assumed you look like that all the time. Okay, so I'm going to jump right in with the first question, talking about packing for Mars. And this question is from Ryby 2.
Okay.
Mary, how did you come to choose the topic for packing for Mars?
I chose this topic, well, you know, all my books are essentially human bodies in unusual circumstances. That's kind of the, in Spook, I guess it was the soul, but in unusual circumstances, a science lab. So it kind of fit with the general theme, and I got interested in it because I have an acquaintance who worked at the bed rest facility, that very surreal place in Galveston, Texas, where NASA pays people to lie in bed for 3 months or more to study the effects of weightlessness. So that kind of got me rolling on trying to see what other kinds of bizarre simulations of space and go on, and then just the whole notion of strangeness of life without gravity.
So were you a space geek before this book?
No, not really. I was 10 when we landed on the moon, and I don't remember it. I was 10 years old, and I was obviously like next door playing with the bulges or something. I wasn't really, and I never watched Star Trek. I'm not a sci-fi gal. No, it was more just for me the kind of eccentric science that goes into, you know, trying to figure out how to keep humans alive up there. So I know I wasn't much of a space geek, but I am now.
I was going to ask. So now, I mean, it's fascinating. And if you read the book, it is truly, there's plenty of eccentric science of human bodies.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I wish that our cable package included NASA TV, because when I was in Houston, that I stayed in, you know, Extended Stay America, Johnson Space Center, right across the street from the Johnson Space Center. And I would, when I'd sit and have my little lonely takeout meals, I would watch NASA TV, and I'm just totally a NASA TV junkie. But we don't get that in our cable package, so I've had to give it up.
How did you choose the title? You've got Stiff, Spook, Bonk, and then Packing for Mars.
I know, a lot of syllables, right?
oddly many.
Yeah, well, we tried to come up with one word. Just couldn't find a word that suggested the human side of it. A lot of the words that people, that myself and my editor came up with, are kind of the rocket side of it, like blast or zoom, or they really aren't there. Or space sounds like a James Michener novel, or there may even be one called Space. Orbit, my agent suggested orbit, but that kind of, to me, that sounds like chewing gum.
Oh, right.
I liked Brink, but my editor said, well, what does that even mean? And it sounds like a prison book. So we couldn't come up with one. We failed.
I had a laugh out loud moment when I was reading Packing for Mars about how the NASA staff thought you were going to use their positional trainer toilet in their lab. It was a toilet, but it wasn't supposed to be used. I had to laugh silently so I wouldn't wake up my baby. Like, it was that funny. And I also can't stop thinking about the idea of how we rely on gravity when pooping.
I know, separation. It's really, that was a whole concept that it just never occurred to me, that without gravity, That shit doesn't fall in the toilet.
It's true. The
Yeah.
logistics of space pooping. So,
Yeah.
what are some of the other things that you, since having done all this research, that you can't stop thinking about? What are the pieces that stayed with you?
Well, the zero gravity flight, obviously, because that was just so cool to not weigh anything. It's not like floating in water. It's totally different, and I so want to do it again. But I'm too cheap to pay the $5,000 that they charge you. But I guess also the Japanese astronaut candidates or applicants sitting there for an hour folding origami cranes. That was, the little colorful pieces of paper. That was sort of dreamlike and unforgettable. What else? Holding that chunk of Mars. That was wild. That's a great big old meteorite that they have at Johnson Space Center that was just, heavy as a bowling ball. Just piece of Mars. That was very cool.
All right, well, I'm going to go back to RIBY2 again. Did the recent NASA budget cuts have any effect on your research and your writing of the book?
Oh yeah, we're talking to advanced galleys already out, and then NASA Obama comes out with his budget saying, "We will not be going back to the moon. No moon base. That's over and done." Meanwhile, I've spent there's a couple chapters that are directly based on work that was going on for the moon base. I mean, they were chapters about a more general topic, so it's not like I had to take them out, but I had to do a lot of sort of quick fancy footwork to set them up differently, explain why they're, explain what was going on, and also put in the stuff about the budget. So there's all these sentences in there. Right now, we don't know where these rovers are going. We possibly are going to Mars, but we don't know, and we're not going back to the moon, although the budget hasn't passed, so we don't know.
Right.
So
Wow.
yeah, that was particularly stressful timing.
Well, I wonder if this book having come out will affect that.
I do too. I do kind of, I hope it has a positive effect.
Right, that's what I would expect. All right, here's a question from Charlie B3. Are
Uh-huh.
there any surprising NASA or other sources that were especially tight-lipped in a stop looking for this or we'll have to hurt a cute puppy kind of way?
Oh, we'll have to what?
Hurt a cute puppy.
Oh, hurt. I said herd. Oh,
No, that would be great.
I'll do that. Oh, yeah, that's very funny. That was the biggest challenge of the book, access. Because I'm, me, I was like calling up the public affairs office saying, "Can I go along with those people who, when the shuttle comes down after 2 weeks in space, who go in to clean it? Can I go with them? And like, can I talk to the guy who collected the pieces after Columbia exploded? Can I go?" They're all like, "No."
Yeah, well, I'm sure no would be is their default answer rather than yes.
They're tremendously helpful when it's something that they're comfortable with. But there's sort of like the cadaver chapter. I mean, in the end, they did relent. I kind of went through Ohio State University, who was doing, they were doing the actual collaboration between them and NASA and the Transportation Research Center. And initially, they were like, the woman of public affairs was like, "It's okay with me, but then we got to check with headquarters." And then it's like, and then I wouldn't hear back for a while, and then it would be, "Well, the people at Ohio State are not cool with it." And I go, "But I talked to them, and they're okay." "Oh, they are? Oh, well, then it's, you just can't." And then the guy at Ohio State says, "Well, just come here. Just come here and we'll deal with it then." So that morning was a little stressful because the poor guys from NASA are like, "What are you doing here? Who are you?" And they're on the phone with public affairs, like telling me, I'm telling the graduate students, "Please don't talk to her. She's not supposed to be here." But in the end, the public affairs woman said, "It's fine. It's
Wow.
fine. You can talk to her." Yeah, it was a strange journey. It's a government agency, so it's always a little, there's like, to set up an interview with an astronaut who's in the current astronaut corps, you actually fill out an application. It's like a form that you turn in, and it works. It's very governmenty,
Yeah, I would
but it
expect
but
that would make
it,
this particular book and this research more difficult. I'm surprised. I can't believe your tenacity. That's awesome.
I'm very tenacious. Yes.
Oh, good. So would you say that's one of the qualities needed to be able to be, Mary Roach?
Yes, persistence. And just a willingness to be an utter pain in the ass and to
Awesome.
drive people nuts and wear them down to a stub.
Well, it makes for great reading, I have to say.
Yeah, there's some of the, yeah, there was like that one when I asked the the public affairs woman at Marshall, the NASA branch in Alabama, I think it is, about the zero gravity sex hoax. And she writes back with this, oh, here's somebody who could talk to you about the history of the neutral buoyancy tank. I'm like, did I ask about the history of the neutral buoyancy tank? I don't think so.
All right, here's a question from Al in New York. So as funny as this book is, it's also grounded in a lot of hard facts. And those facts seem to indicate that given the current state of technology and the limitations of the human body, it's a rather dicey proposition that anyone would survive the journey to Mars and back. Given all that you've learned, how do you think we could be successful in sending humans to Mars and get them home, well, in one piece, at least get them there? This Al is a big fan of the manned space program, but until Scotty can beam us up, he's starting to think robots could do better.
Yeah, I can see his point there. I think that the plan that I've heard that really is that seems to be the most doable would be to send folks, older astronauts, because, I mean, the radiation is a big problem. You don't want to send somebody who hasn't had kids, who's got a long life ahead of them, because that's a pretty heavy dose of radiation. Mm-hmm. So, but there are astronauts who would love to go to Mars and stay on Mars for the remainder, say they're 60 or 50, mm-hmm. To stay there doing science and live out the rest of their lives there. And so you could resupply. We are very good at putting unmanned landers down on Mars, so you could send the stuff that they need to them, and then they could stay there, and if they develop cancer in 20 years and die, then that's sort of what they might have done on Earth, and they'd rather do it on Mars.
Sure.
But that's a really, you know, that's not something that NASA wants to do. That's not something they're considering a one way, because it seems cruel. Even though these are people who want to do it, it seems unthinkable to send somebody. It's like, you know, sending them to Siberia times 1,000.
Sure. I was surprised at how much the PR of space exploration affected the decisions.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, really, PR is the reason, is one of the big reasons to be doing a Mars mission, because it's very hard to get people's attention focused on space exploration. After the moon landing, people are like, whatever, astronauts. So, you know, but a Mars mission, everybody would be watching. Everybody, the whole planet. I mean, it would be extraordinary. And so, yeah, it is in some ways a way to generate a tremendous amount of interest and support, unless things go horribly wrong.
Right.
It's really, really bad PR. So, I mean, I think that I think there are ways. You know, the bone and muscle loss, I mean, you can create artificial gravity, and I think that would be the way to go, to create a spinning room, like a living module that is, like in 2001 they had that. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. then you wouldn't have the muscle wasting and bone loss that it would be an expensive and engineering-wise difficult thing to do, but that would really resolve a lot of the problems. And the radiation, there's ways to really mitigate that.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not something, again, that you'd want to send somebody young up there for. But I don't think it's that. I mean, there's been people in space for a year, so all right, 2 years. You know, a year is not a big deal. It's tough, it's hard, but the people who've done it, you know, like Polyakov, that guy in Russia, he'd do it again. He doesn't really think it's a huge challenge, and you know, he kind of scoffs at the whole psychological issues. I think that people would be so, I mean, what you're doing is so incredible and so exciting that, you know, that the whole business of the boredom and the petty bickering, the stuff that you get in isolation chambers, you know, that's not really appropriate for somebody who's actually going to Mars. Just the psychology that we can't even simulate here on Earth. Who knows the feelings that you would have going so far away, doing something so unprecedented. I think it's something you can't even and you can't anticipate what it'll be like for those people. You just have to do a little bit of the Columbus thing and just like, I don't know what's out there, but I'm going to go.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So here's a question from Daniel X. Were some nations' programs more forthcoming with information than others?
It wasn't so much the nations as the astronauts, like astronauts versus cosmonauts. The cosmonauts that I spoke to, but bear in mind, these are folks who are retired. You generally, retired astronauts are much more forthcoming than astronauts or cosmonauts who are still in in the employ of the government. They, because those guys are the people who are still active astronauts or cosmonauts are really the front lines of public relations. They're the people who kind of represent the space agency, and they are very careful. They have to be very careful in what they say. They are honest, and they'll answer your questions, but you don't really sit down and have a free-willing conversation about zero-gravity sex.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that you do with somebody, either in the U.S. or in Russia, who has retired. So for me, it was more active versus retired was the big noticeable difference. Cosmonauts versus astronauts, I mean, they're just in general, cosmonauts love to talk about, you know, they was like, yeah, let's talk about sex. You know, there wasn't any like, ooh, how am I going to phrase this or anything. But then again, there's, you know, I talked to a couple astronauts, retired astronauts here in the U.S. who were absolutely fine discussing whatever I wanted to talk about. I was more hesitant to bring stuff up just because I had the sense that I didn't want to put them on the spot or, you know, make them feel any pressure to talk about something they didn't want to. So I think I approached it a little more hesitantly than I normally approach these topics. And the other thing with cross-cultural crews in space, they train together. So they all tend to kind of gravitate toward the mean.
Mm-hmm.
Like the flight surgeon, the medical guy in Japan said that although Japanese astronauts, you know, they tend to behave very well. He said behave too much well is how he put it. They are very conscious of you know, being polite and not confrontational with others. And he said that's the concern, that they're too much that way. But since they go and train for months with Americans, he said they become more like Americans. So by the time a Mars crew would get up into space, I think they would all be relating on a much closer level. They'd be sort of, will have all moved toward the average a bit.
Oh, I guess they all have the culture of Earth in common.
Yeah, that's right. And the culture of space, even more to the point that they are training in this very unique culture. We can't say very unique. In this unique culture of space that really, I think, kind of equalizes everybody in a way.
So now that you're an expert on the uncomfortable, the bizarre, the cool aspects of space travel, if given the opportunity, would you go into space?
Oh, absolutely. I would go 2 weeks. A two-week trip to the moon, I would absolutely. I would be happier if I could be guaranteed that I'd make it back in one piece and there wouldn't be any unpleasant explosions or any mishaps. But, yeah, that kind of stuff wouldn't bother me. I'm a backpacker. I'm somebody who is so willing to put up with crapping in a hole, eating terrible food, sleeping on a hard ground, being hot, being tired.
Mm-hmm.
All of that to me is worth it to get where you're going when you're backpacking, because it's just such an extraordinary place to be. Up in the Sierras is where my husband and I go. And I think space is a similar, if you're somebody who doesn't mind that kind of inconvenience and compromised hygiene, just, you know, to go backpacking, the idea of putting up with it for space is no big deal.
Back to you interviewing different people for this book or for any of your books, what qualities does it take to be able to get a good quotable interview from somebody?
Persistence again. The other thing I always recommend to journalists is to spend a couple days with somebody who, you know, if it's somebody who's a key element in a chapter of your book, you would really want to, if possible, spend a couple of days, because then things start to normalize a little bit. People, if you only have a couple of hours with someone, you stick a tape recorder in front of them, they're a little, they're in sort of interview mode, and they're trying to sound a certain way. And it's not that, you know, you want to get them to relax and then, aha, you know, grab them or anything. It's just that the interview becomes more conversational, and it goes to more interesting places, and you just always end up getting more interesting material later on in the visit. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just good journalism, you know, just not to, you know, spend only an hour with your source. Well, certainly somebody who's working on a book where they're going to be focusing just on a few characters would spend weeks and months. But in my case, you can sometimes, you know, you can just sort of set up an hour interview and be done, but that doesn't tend to get you very interesting to very interesting places.
Yeah.
So that's also important. And also, I don't write out questions and read them because, I mean, you have to do that for radio or for like what we're doing. But I tend to just have a general sense of what I need to cover, and I let the conversation go where it goes. And then if there's anything I didn't get, I can always call back or email. So it is much, it's pretty random conversation, and I let it, I kind of let it wander a lot.
I have to know about your footnotes. How do you decide what gets footnoted? Is it purely having to do with how to organize the information in the book, or is it, I feel like sometimes it's the text equivalent of a rim shot.
That's a good way to describe it. It's, it is stuff that doesn't quite fit in the narrative, and I don't feel like I can burden the reader with a parenthesis, or I can't burden the paragraph or the sentence or the parenthetical reference. So if I put it at the bottom, I feel like the person can come back to it later or skip it. It gives them some options. So it's, but it's material that I'm way too indulgent to leave out. It's stuff that I found that I love and I want in there, or I just, you know, something it triggered a idea in that doesn't really fit the flow of the narrative at all. So and I can't bear to leave it out, so I put it in a footnote. So that's what it is. It's just stuff that doesn't, I can't work it in gracefully. And I put a big demand on the reader as it is. I'm pretty ADD in the way I write, and I track down tangents. And so for footnotes, it would be, if they were in the text, they'd be like tangents on tangents. And I feel like at a certain point, the reader would throw that book down in disgust and go, Jesus, I can't read this thing. So I put them down at the bottom of the page where they can be skipped if they're too annoying.
Sure. Here's a question from Daniel X. Given your great success as an author, please tell us about the mechanics of your writing. Do you work on a daily schedule? Do you have a particular location where you write? Do you have to be drinking Earl Grey tea? You know, what is it?
I can't write without a good cup of coffee. Just, you know, I'm kind of a coffee snob. I've got to make it, or I don't have to. Pizza's good too. So coffee is part of the ritual, and I don't drink a lot. It's mostly it's a couple cups a day, and it's just it kind of anchors me to my work to have the cup of coffee there, and it's just the whole kind of writing feeling that happens, and it isn't even I don't even think it's the caffeine. It's just something that gets me going. I tend to write more in the afternoon versus the morning, because morning is email heavy. Get the East Coast writing, my publisher's out there, and a lot of sources are on the East Coast, and so I'm doing a lot of back and forth emailing, setting things up, doing interviews, and then it tends to quiet down mid-afternoon, and that's when I do most of my writing, like from 3 to 6 or 7.
All right, Ryby2 asks, your writing makes me laugh out loud. Are there any authors who have the same effect on you?
Yes, oh, for sure. Dave Barry makes me laugh out loud. Dave Barry books, as silly as they are, when I've been depressed or upset about something, I use Dave. I don't have any lying around right now, but when I have had them, I use them like it's like therapy. It totally takes me out of whatever mood I'm in and makes me laugh, and it's better than any shrink could possibly be. And I also feel that way about Bill Bryson. Bill Bryson is somebody who has less, yucks per minute, because he's also teaching you a lot in his books. But Bill Bryson's books, for sure, he's a real, he does what I do, only better. So I really, I'm always excited when a new Bill Bryson book comes out.
So I have the same question from Richard Darris and Ape, and that is, will you marry me?
Well, the divorce proceedings will take some time here, so I'll have to get back to him on how that's going. No, that is hugely flattering. I'm not in divorce proceedings. I'm happily married. But,
both Richard Darris and Ape referenced that you're smart and you're funny and witty, and that they're both big fanboys of you. So you apparently are above the status that you get to have fanboys.
Yay. I love it. I want to have a fan convention. One time I went to the Dolly Parton fan club meeting in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. And there was like hundreds of Dolly Parton fans in the room, and they were bringing up offerings. Like one of them had made a fly swatter cover that said Dolly on it. That was like, needlepoint kind of thing. And they were laying these, it was kind of like laying them on the altar. And I thought, wow, Cool. I want a fan club like that.
You can handle a little bit more adoration.
Yeah, I want the homemade fly swatter cover. I didn't even have a fly swatter, but I want the homemade fly swatter cover.
Naturally, to cover your fly swatter.
Yes.
All right, here's a question from Ninja Penguin. Is there somewhere a journal for the strange and amusing scientific research? And is that something that they can subscribe to?
Yes, there is a journal that I just recently met this guy. We share one brain between us, to use that line from Best of Show. Well, this guy, the journal is called the Journal of Improbable Research, and he's the guy who does the Ig Nobel Awards. It's this, it's like a play on the Nobel Prize. They give these awards for, like the people who had sex in the MRI tube, that got an Ig Nobel. And anyway, this journal, you can subscribe to it, and it covers all the kinds of, I don't subscribe to it because I like to find them on my own, and I hate when he's already found them, but he finds them all. Anyway, it's a very funny journal. It's called the Journal of Improbable Research.
Great.
And you can easily find it on the internet and subscribe. It's a very funny, quirky, he just finds all of the weirdest, like self-esteem in chickens. Like somebody would have done a study on, just the most hysterical, weird research. And he covers it all in a very kind of droll, straight-faced way. It's very funny.
So to sum up a bunch of different questions from different members, there's a request for you to do packing for Jupiter or Venus. One of the people who asked you to marry them says that he's a huge microbiology fan and would love to see if you do that as your next topic. Basically, what's next? What would you like to look into next?
Microbiology is something I have given a lot of thought to, because one of my favorite stories ever was there's this microbiologist named Chuck Gerba at the University of Arizona, and he is hysterical. And we did this, I went and visited him and went to his house, and he's a real slob, but he's also the guy who knows everything about how many, colonies of fecal bacteria there are on the average, that he knows that the toilet seat is actually very clean. Your sink is way filthier in terms of the number of bacteria. And he knows all this stuff, and he's fascinating. But the challenge with that topic for me was that it's all invisible, and it's hard to, I can't sort of paint the scenes the way I do when I'm covering something like sex labs or mm-hmm. NASA. But I have, and there's been a bunch of books, Carl Zimmer did one on E. coli, but his is way more cerebral than anything I would do. But that's a great idea, and I may well figure out a way to come at it. So, and I'm working on a new one. It's, keeping it a little under wraps for now.
Oh.
I am off on a new
Well,
adventure.
How can we start the fan club and put the alternate together if we don't have the new topic?
I know. I don't know why, it's so early on. I just want to keep it fresh for a little while.
I understand. I am trying to be tenacious.
No, yes, you are. You almost had me there. I did for a second think, oh, I should just tell her.
I'm being just like you, Mary Roach.
Yes, you're doing very well.
So I have to ask, did you happen to catch the TV show Defying Gravity?
No, I didn't. My editor sent it to me saying, hey, good title. Too bad we didn't think of that.
It's amazing. And it's so much of what you talk about in the book, of the interesting little nuances, especially the psychology, are played out in that show.
Huh. And was it a comedy or a drama? Kind of both.
Adventure drama.
Oh.
And it ends up having a little bit of a sci-fi angle to it, but it's very realistic in the, I feel, in my not knowing this at all, about, like looking at Pecking for Mars, about...
Right, the psychology.
A huge part was that they don't, they would all keep everything inside. If you had a problem or, something go wrong, you would not talk about it because you wanted to fly that, that desire.
Yeah, right, which is, I think it's a really tough job.
Do you have some suggestions if you read Packing for Mars and you realize you want to geek out on space stuff a little bit more, where would you turn to next?
The astronaut memoir, the one that I thought was really, really readable, funny, and actually really honest about NASA. Well, there's a lot of honesty in these astronaut memoirs because they write them when they've retired. But the one that I found most entertaining was called Riding Rockets, and it's by Mike Mullane, Mullane. And he's funny. The guy can write, and there's not a lot of stuff about, you know, his childhood, and, you know, sometimes the astronaut memoirs are a little bit, you got to sort of slog through the non-astronaut stuff too,
right,
which can be interesting sometimes and less interesting other times. So that is a good one. The one I love, the one that's absolutely, it's not in print. You can get it on the evil Amazon, but it's called Diary of a Cosmonaut, 211 Days in Space. And it's written, it's just diary entries, not changed, just edited for length. This guy, Lebedev, who was up on Salyut in, I don't know, early 70s, I'm guessing. And that is just the most realistic and kind of occasionally very heart-wrenching and sometimes touching and sometimes funny look at what it is like to spend, you know, 211 days
mm-hmm.
in orbit. And I really recommend that book. That was my favorite. It's not easy to find it. It is on the internet. You can find it easily. It's a used book. It's not in print anymore.
Okay. Yeah, I'll link to see if I can find a copy.
Yeah,
of
maybe
it.
Powell's or something like that.
Yeah. The last question I'd like to ask you is the tagline for Library Thing. We're a social networking site, and our tagline is "What's on your bookshelf?" So I have to ask, what's on your bookshelf?
Well, right now there's a big pile next to my bed, and one of them is a book that I was asked to blurb, which is really interesting. It's not out yet. It's called Moonwalking with Einstein, and it's about the human memory. And it's this guy who, he's a science writer, but he became the world memory champion in it's practical in that if you're like me, you have terrible memory, it would help you. But it's also just really an interesting narrative and a lot of interesting science about human memory.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I just started, I've read about 50 pages, and that's really good. There's a book called Poorly Made in China, which was really interesting, about this guy who speaks fluent Chinese, and he became the go-between for people in the U.S. who want to make crappy things in China, and the factories in, like, Guangdong and those provinces where they crank out stuff, and all these amazing cultural misunderstandings and differences of philosophy, and he's just sort of stuck in the middle, but it's just really illuminating because it was the Economist's best business book of the year, but it doesn't feel like a business book. That one is good. Oh, what else? Little Bee, I just finished. The Help someone gave me, and I read the first 10 pages and of course got distracted by something, but it seemed like it was pretty, pretty interesting, but who knows when I'll get back to it. Let's see what else is on my pile over there. Somebody gave me a copy of a book called On Being Wrong, I think it's called, On Being Wrong, something which it sounds like an odd topic, but the first few pages, again, I'm always reading the first chapter and then getting distracted, but it's really well written. On Being Wrong, I don't have the author's name. That's what's on the pile.
Excellent.
Right now. Not the shelf, but the pile. The pile is the stuff that, you know, I should be actually getting to or have intended to read.
So would you say of your reading style that you do pick up a book and start it and then see if it catches you or if you're going to go back to it?
Yes. The other thing is on the pile is a book coming out that I'm reviewing for the Times, and it's called You Don't Look Like Anyone I Know, about a woman with face blindness,
mm-hmm.
but she's a poet. She's an amazing writer. It's kind of a little like Mary Carr's book, The Liar's Club. That is also on the pile, and it's not out yet, though.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always distracted by books that I'm either reviewing or I'm blurbing. But when I don't do that many blurbs anymore. I pick up a book and I read a bit of it, and I have every intention of going back to it, but sometimes that doesn't happen. So, I read the first quarter of so many books, but don't make it to the end. Not because the book is bad, but just because I just can't get back to all of them.
Well, as a reader and, you know, as someone who's speaking as the voice of a website full of readers, I have to say that's a terrible curse you have.
It's horrible. It's the worst thing about being a writer. The worst thing about being an author is that you stop having time to read the books that you want to read. You end up reading books that someone has given you for one reason or another, or that you've agreed to review or blurb, and you never get around to the books that are on your list of the things you want to read. I'm looking forward to Jonathan Franzen's new book because I really liked The Corrections. But there's so many books I want to read, and I don't. And plus, you know, you've got a stack of books when you're doing your own book. Or for me, anyway, I'm going through. I have so much reading material for my own research. I just don't have a lot of time to read.
So
can I tell you my favorite library thing story?
Oh, please.
Okay, there's this. I printed it out. Somebody forwarded it to me, and it's that somebody said that they just finished reading the Aeneid. And they found it disappointing. They were about to read Mary Roach's Spook and looking forward to it. So I love that. The first time I've been compared to the, you know, who the hell wrote the Aeneid? Or whatever the old Greek was. So that's my favorite.
Wow.
My favorite line from Library Thing. But it's a great site. And again, I wish I had time to be on there. I wish I had time for all these things.
Yeah.
That I don't have time for.
Well, I'm really glad that what you're doing instead is writing funny, awesome books.
Well, me too.
Good. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for spending time doing this podcast with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I was happy to. Please thank everybody for their questions and their enthusiasm and support and for reading my books. It's such a cool thing as a writer to have people read what you write. You know, you take that for granted sometimes, but it's quite an honor.
Well, we'll be starting up the Mary Roach altar and fan club directly after this podcast is published.
Right. Yes, get working on those needle-crafted fly swatter covers.
Oh, we will.
No, I'm kidding. Don't. I'm not trying to get a fly swatter. I don't even have a fly swatter, so it was just it's an image that stayed with me, like, you know, the separation on the toilet or whatever. What was the one that stayed with you?
Oh, when you were asking these very serious questions about the toilet, I'm going to let you line, like, basically you're going to line your butt up so that the hole worked. And they really thought that what you were next going to do was crap on their test.
Yeah. Jim Broyan goes, Mary, you can't defecate on that toilet.
Well, and then they reiterated just to make it absolutely clear that they do not want to be cleaning up your shit.
Yeah, Mary, that's not a working toilet.
Well, on that note.
All right. Well, I really, really enjoyed this. Thank you so much, Sonia.
Yes, thank you.
This has been Sonia Green interviewing Mary Roach for LibraryThing.com.